That is our chance here, and hopefully the human solidarity, that's what movements are all about, is our hope.
Well, people can see you tonight at Powell's Books, is that true?
That's, I believe, at 7:30 at Powell's beloved City of Books.
Downtown at 10th and West Burnside. It's been great talking with you, Bill McKibben. Thanks for coming to KBOO.
Well, I couldn't have enjoyed it more.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from the Portland State University Hatfield School of Government, offering a new master's degree in nonprofit leadership for those who believe in the power of collective action for social change. More information online at pdx.edu/Hatfield School.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Dessert Evening with Rumi on Saturday, May 4th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Tabor Space in Portland. Dessert Evening with Rumi will be an evening of sharing Rumi poetry and stories, live Turkish music, sacred dance of whirling dervishes, and desserts donated by Portland individuals and businesses. Again, that's Dessert Evening with Rumi on Saturday, May 4th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Tabor Space, 5441 Southeast Belmont Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Peggy Dean's Guide to Nature Drawing and Watercolor Book Release Party on Sunday, May 5th from 2 to 5 p.m. at Tillamook Station in Portland. Artist, author, and art instructor Peggy Dean presents this nature drawing guide that teaches you drawing and watercolor techniques. The event also features food and treats, art supplies, a selfie station, and more. Again, that's Peggy Dean's Guide to Nature Drawing and Watercolor Book Release Party on Sunday, May 5th from 2 to 5 p.m. at Tillamook Station, 665 North Tillamook Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland. Up next, Rising Up Sonali.
So it doesn't matter if I'm there or not, right?
You were just afraid they'd abandon you. So you abandoned them. You distanced yourself from the whole thing.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, Special Counsel Robert Mueller is reportedly in direct talks with House Judiciary Committee members about whether he will testify in front of Congress. The reports first emerged on NBC and ABC News based on sources in the Judiciary Committee and come a day after Attorney General William Barr refused to testify to the same panel. On Thursday, the Washington Post reported that it had obtained a formal complaint letter from White House Attorney Emmett Flood, written to the Justice Department last month about the special counsel report. According to the Post, in the letter, Flood accused Miller of exceeding his authority by spilling into public view a recitation of facts far more detailed than what is typically included in criminal indictments. He described the report as prosecutorial curiosity, part Truth Commission report, and part law school exam paper. The letter asserts that Mueller should have exonerated President Donald Trump since it did not recommend prosecution. However, Mr. Mueller cited the Justice Department's position that a sitting president cannot be indicted as a reason why he did not recommend prosecution. Meanwhile, Trump said in a Fox News interview on Thursday that he was not willing to let former White House counselor Don McGahn testify to Congress about his documented actions in the Mueller report. He also said that he approved of Barr's refusal to testify to the House Judiciary Committee. And on Friday morning, Trump had his first publicly known phone conversation with Russian President Vladimir Putin, and the Mueller report was apparently among the things the two discussed. According to the Wall Street Journal, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation came up briefly, and that the leader said, "It's over and there was no collusion and it was time to move on." Trump and Putin also discussed the situations in Venezuela and North Korea. The latest jobs report is out, and as per the Labor Department, the economy added 263,000 jobs in the month of April, a larger number than the 190,000 that economists expected. The unemployment rate has fallen to a new low of 3.6%. But according to the New York Times, as good as the dip in the unemployment rate looks, the factors behind it aren't as hopeful as the headline number itself. There was a big drop in the number of people who said they were looking for work. The labor force participation rate, which measures the share of people 16 and older who are employed or seeking a job, fell to 62.8% from 63% in March. The U.S. Senate on Thursday failed to override President Trump's veto of a bill to end U.S. support for Saudi Arabia's devastating war on Yemen. The bill, introduced by Senator Bernie Sanders, had passed with all Democrats and several Republicans voting in favor, and had also passed the Democrat-controlled House. But after Trump vetoed it, a two-thirds majority was required in the Senate to override the veto, and that measure failed by 14 votes. Saudi bombs have killed tens of thousands of Yemenis with U.S.-supplied weapons and direct military advice. Tens of millions remain at risk of starvation. In other news, a group of activists calling themselves the Embassy Protection Collective have been camped outside the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. to offer food and medical aid to those who appear to be trapped inside. The situation has developed as the U.S. continues to offer direct encouragement to a coup to overthrow the Venezuelan government of Nicolas Maduro. On Thursday, several activists were arrested, including Ariel Gold of Code Pink, who has been a guest on our show multiple times. Supporters of opposition leader Juan Guaido have been counter-protesting outside the embassy and have even reportedly assaulted the pro-Maduro activists. In climate news, a massive cyclone is hitting the eastern coast of India, prompting the evacuation of more than a million people. Cyclone Fani is considered one of the strongest storm systems to ever hit the Indian subcontinent, with wind speeds of more than 120 miles per hour being recorded. Meteorologists have deemed the storm equivalent to a Category 5 hurricane. Hundreds have so far been reportedly injured, and relief and rescue efforts are already underway. Meanwhile, school-aged children around the world are expanding their Fridays for Future climate strikes, which famed Swedish activist Greta Thunberg had called for several months ago. There are now reportedly more than 700 strikes of school children skipping school to protest climate change around the world, including in Australia, Uganda, and Pakistan. Here in the U.S., the Trump administration on Thursday announced a dismantling of safety regulations that had been put into place for offshore drilling operations after the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill. The 2010 accident had resulted in 11 deaths and 200 million gallons of oil spilled into the Gulf of Mexico. The Obama administration had put in place safety regulations to prevent future such spills, which oil and gas drilling companies complained were too onerous. Now, the fossil fuel-embracing Trump regime has decided to undo those safety regulations. Interior Secretary David Bernhardt said in a statement on Thursday, quote, "Incorporating the best available science, best practices, and technological innovations of the past decade, the rule eliminates unnecessary regulatory burdens while maintaining safety and environmental protection offshore." Bernhardt had until recently worked as a lobbyist for fossil fuel companies. A migrant family has reportedly drowned in the Rio Grande this week while trying to cross over to the United States. At least three children are feared dead, among them a 10-month-old baby whose body was just recovered. The family crossed the river in a raft that capsized, according to a statement by Border Patrol. Some members of the family survived as they were able to swim to safety. According to Reuters, drownings are common on the Rio Grande, which makes up part of the U.S.-Mexico border, as migrants try to cross on often overcrowded makeshift rafts with no life jackets. But rescues have increased since October as record numbers of Central American families try to enter the United States. And finally, the Trump administration on Thursday released a 440-page set of rules during a National Day of Prayer ceremony that would allow healthcare providers, including doctors, nurses, insurers, and others, to refuse care based on their own personal religious or moral beliefs. The rules also encourage parents to refuse treatment for their children based on religion. Fundamentalist groups have been lobbying for such rules for years, calling them conscience protections. Critics point out that it is a green light for doctors and nurses to discriminate against minorities, such as LGBTQ patients. The group Americans United for Separation of Church and State released a statement denouncing the rules as, quote, "the Trump administration's most dangerous attempt yet to weaponize religious freedom." And that does it for our headlines today. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump this week announced the release of a lengthy set of rules that critics say gives the religious right more cover to discriminate against women and minority groups based on their personal beliefs. The document, coming ironically from the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Civil Rights, is 440 pages in length and was announced by Trump at the White House during the National Day of Prayer on Thursday. The rules include allowing healthcare workers from refusing to offer services such as abortion and sterilization. We turn to Rob Boston, Director of Communications at the group Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Welcome, Rob.
Thanks for having me on, Sonali.
So first, I understand that these rules are called, they're called rules of conscience or conscience rules. This is part, of course, of the long-standing religious rights attempt to define their religious freedom as, constitutionally protected religious freedom as something so broad that it impacts the rights of others, right?
That's right. You know, historically, religious freedom has been interpreted as your right to worship or not, as you see fit, to join in worship with others, to read religious books, to pass that on to your children. But religious freedom has never been interpreted as a device to allow one person to take away the rights of another or to interfere with that person's private health decisions. So this really is, in our perspective, a radical redefinition of the very idea of religious freedom.
So I understand, of course, very early in his presidency, in early 2019, Trump signed an executive order that he called Free Speech and Religious Liberty. And this set of rules that was released builds upon that executive order?
Well, this has been something that we've grappled with for a long time as a nation, to the extent that you want to grant these types of so-called conscience objections. And there were rules and procedures under the Obama administration, but of course the Trump administration has been systematically dismantling all the rules and regulations from the previous administration. And they've been doing this largely at the behest of the religious right. Religious right organizations favor an extremely broad interpretation of conscience that would allow people to really, I think, interfere with medical decisions that are best left with the patient and his or her doctors. But instead, we're seeing this situation where pretty much anybody can, in the medical field, can interject themselves into that relationship. And that includes the receptionist who's answering the phone, someone who may be handling some insurance paperwork, even custodians and people in support services. It's a very broad set of rules. And I think it, far from adding clarity, it just confuses the issue.
What basis is the Trump administration putting these laws out as? I mean, isn't this something that Congress should be deciding? I mean, how is the president unilaterally deciding that people have the right to discriminate?
Well, that's a very good question. There are certain policies whereby the government can issue rules and regulations, and federal departments can do that, and of course, the president does have the power under some circumstances to issue executive orders. But what we're really seeing during the Trump era is an unprecedented grab by the executive office to expand those powers pretty widely. Because Congress, at least one chamber of it right now, is in the hands of the Democrats, the president isn't able really to get legislation through. So instead, they're trying this regulatory route. I mean, think about this for a minute. This is a 440-page document. It's as long as the Mueller report. So it's just this incredibly huge and dense document that this department has issued. And when that filters down to sort of the average person working in the healthcare industry, what do you think their ability to synthesize that and put it into action is going to be? I mean, we have lawyers that have spent days looking at this, trying to sort through it and figure out what it says. The average healthcare worker is not going to be able to do that. And I think what's going to happen is they're just going to assume that they have rights that they may not have and start denying people services.
The word abortion appears 135 times in this document. As far as you can tell, what does this document do on, or what does it allow people to do or allow them to not do where abortion is concerned?
Well, there are already certain laws and regulations that cover conscience rights in abortion, but those covered, doctors and nurses. Now we're seeing a kind of a radical expansion of that policy to people working in very tangential areas of healthcare. I think, you're talking about people whose main job is paperwork or people who may be involved in transporting patients, this sort of thing. It's really designed to just broadly push that exemption as much as it can. I think that this is really an attempt by the administration to undermine abortion rights because the courts have not yet taken the step of overturning Roe versus Wade, which of course is what many conservatives would like. I think it's what President Trump is working toward with his extremely conservative appointments to the Supreme Court. But since they don't have that ruling in hand yet, they're just trying to chip away at it and put as many obstacles in the place of it as they can. And unfortunately, I think they've been pretty successful.
There's also assisted suicide and sterilization, which is something that there's a lot of worry over, and that this document spells out rules for. Can you explain that a little bit? I mean, assisted suicide, I'm assuming they're worried about the growing number of states that are now allowing people to take charge of their own fate, if you will, based on if they happen to have a terminal disease?
Yes, exactly. We are seeing that movement start to spread in the states. And in some cases, people are sort of taking matters into their own hands by putting, ballot referenda questions on. And the polls show that there is support there for people having more determination over what happens to them with their end-of-life care when they're facing illnesses that will inevitably be fatal. But there's great resistance to that among the religious right, among the Roman Catholic hierarchy. It's kind of the flip side of the abortion issue. Just as they want to be able to control how women can give birth and under what circumstances, they also want to control what happens to folks at the end of their lives. And they are looking for ways to interfere in that relationship too. So these rules are designed, again, to put more barriers, more obstacles in the way of people's rights to be able to make a decision about what happens to them at the end of their lives. And again, that is something that really ought to be discussed between the patient, his or her doctor, and relevant family members. But instead, these rules set up a framework whereby absolute strangers can step in and interfere in that process.
I understand that the document doesn't explicitly mention LGBTQ Americans, but what do you worry could be the impact on that specific minority?
Well, if you think about the most kind of conservative religious elements in our society right now, they obsess over a couple issues. One we've already talked about is abortion. But LGBTQ rights is the other one, always looking for ways to cause harms to members of that community, to take away their rights, to refuse to serve them. We see that in the context of businesses. Now it's being extended to healthcare. You think about if somebody's transgender and they need trans-affirming medical care. Again, suddenly you've got people who can start interfering with that. The right of a same-sex couple who may be legally married to seek health care for a child or to engage in fertility treatments, this sort of thing. People can come into this relationship and just start interfering on the basis of their religious beliefs, which may be grounded in bigotry or ignorance, what have you. And that's really what concerns us, is these really are matters that are best left for the people most affected. And instead, you're going to have these strangers coming in and just gumming up the works.
Contraception is another big issue. And there's, of course, been a legal history of whether women have the right to get contraceptive coverage from insurance companies. Contraception is not even anything close to abortion. And yet, of course, the religious right has such trouble with allowing women to simply be able to control their fertility. What is this document? How would this impact contraception coverage?
Yeah, it really is amazing when you think about that issue. I mean, this is something we thought we had nailed down in 1965 when the U.S. Supreme Court declared that adults have the right to use birth control, and that state laws that attempted to make it illegal or gag doctors for even talking about it, those laws were declared unconstitutional in 1965. Yet here we are, 2019, And the religious right groups and some of their allies in the conservative Catholic community have been given this new powerful tool to, again, interfere in a relationship between a doctor and his or her patient. We're seeing that with the contraceptive access. Situations where pharmacists have suddenly said, well, I don't care if you have a prescription from your doctor. I'm not going to give you this medication. I'm not going to issue it. It's just astounding, because the vast majority of Americans, if you look at the polling data on this question, see contraceptives as absolutely non-controversial and support the right of access. And in fact, that's the one thing that actually has been shown to reduce the abortion rate in this country is
to reduce the need
available.
For abortions and unplanned pregnancies in the first place.
Exactly. Yet the same people who are so adamantly anti-abortion are now, many of them, trying to block access to contraceptives. It's astounding.
Right, because in the end, of course, it's about controlling women's bodies. Isn't there a history in this country, a very ugly history, of using religious and moral beliefs as a cover for straight-up discrimination, specifically against Black people and other racial minorities?
Yes, we certainly saw some of that in the Jim Crow era in the South. There were people who made their argument for discrimination on explicitly religious grounds. Well, the Bible says there shall not be any race mixing. And that's why we're not going to allow interracial marriage, or we're not going to allow people to stay in a certain hotel or eat in a restaurant or be in our public institutions like schools and libraries and the swimming pools, all this sort of thing. Now, not all of that was grounded in religious belief in Jim Crow South. You know, some people were just old-fashioned bigots. But there were folks who made that argument. We thought we eradicated that with the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Yet here we are many years later, grappling with some of these same issues again, a little bit of a different stage, but really the same issues, people arguing that because of their religious beliefs, they should be able to exclude services to an entire class of individuals. It's absolutely astounding.
Isn't there an argument to be made that these rules that Trump released on Thursday violate the Civil Rights Act and the protections that people have under that act and other acts?
Well, I certainly think that there are many issues like that that are very compelling. And, you know, when you have something like this happening that's so complicated, so lengthy, so dense, that even, you know, lawyers have to spend days wading through it, we're going to have to see how the dust settles. But obviously, a lot of people are not going to be very happy about these regulations and look at them as a violation of their fundamental rights. And I think they'll take appropriate action from there.
Now, just the fact that this set of rules was released during the National Day of Prayer at the White House is something that I think we should discuss as well, right? What position does your organization take on the fact that we have in this country, where there's supposed to be a separation of church and state, the President of the United States holding a National Day of Prayer? That, you know, although I think technically rabbis and people of other non-Christian faiths are encouraged to attend, is primarily the sort of exercise in affirming the sort of Christian nature of the nation?
Yes, exactly. It's definitely a concern of ours. This National Day of Prayer is something that goes back to the 1950s. Now, so many of these things that we call civil religion, under God being inserted into the Pledge of Allegiance, in God we trust, being named the national motto, even the law codifying and stamping "In God We Trust" on our currency, those all go back to the 1950s and the epic struggle with godless communism, you know, that we went under. National Day of Prayer dates back to that as well. It used to be a floating holiday. It was codified in 1988 as the first Thursday in May. And I do have problems with it. You know, we don't need a directive from the president or a governor or a mayor or anybody else to tell us how to pray, when to pray, or whether we even should pray. That decision is best left to the individual conscience of every American. And some people, many people will pray, others will decide that's not for them and they won't do it. One of the problems I have with this whole National Day of Prayer is that the obvious message being sent to people is that you ought to be praying. That's the good thing to do. That's what real Americans do. What kind of message does that send to the non-believer, the skeptic, or the non-Christian? Because as you point out, you know, despite a little patina of interfaith gloss that gets put on these events, they're often overtly Christian in their approach, and they're really not open to members of other faiths. They're not as welcoming as they ought to be.
And of course, these protections or so-called right to, protections and what we would say is more along the lines of our right to discriminate, generally are understood to apply to largely Christian groups, right? One can only imagine a conservative Muslim saying that, all right, in that case, I too will take the right to, apply Sharia law or whatever, the same kinds of things that a lot of these right-wing Christians say they are fearful of taking over the United States. This set of rules doesn't apply to extremists in other religions, does it?
Well, that's the irony of this. You know, I monitor these religious right groups quite a bit for my job, and you know, they're always screaming about Sharia law and the takeover and people being forced to live under these versions of religious law. And that's really not happening anywhere. I mean, there have actually been states that have passed laws attempting to ban, you know, Sharia. And there's no evidence of this even happening. But what we are seeing, ironically, is the effort to impose fundamentalist Christian law on all of us.
It's a Christian version of Sharia. It's a Christian Taliban.
Yes, exactly. And a very extreme fundamentalist version that actually even millions of American Christians who are liberal or progressive would reject. They're the ones trying to control our reproductive freedom, our sexuality, and to some extent, you know, what material we can access and what we're exposed to. This is the type of power they used to have many years ago. They had all this control, and we have slowly chipped away and pulled their grip off of our necks, and they want to get that back. And I really think that's the thing we really need to be focusing on. This isn't just about, you know, a 440-page directive that the Health and Human Services Department issued. Yes, that's important, but it is part of a larger plan by these folks to basically reassert as much power as they can and as much control as they can over our private lives, our religious lives, our sex lives, our reproductive lives, and the role of women in society. And we have got to fight that every step of the way.
Now, of course, shouldn't the fact that this specific community is relying on Trump as the arbiter of morality really take away from any standing that they have? I mean, how is Trump, you know, even remotely considered a moral figure?
We are living in the strangest times, Sonali, I have to tell you. I see some things that just, they're unbelievable. You would think they were a parody. People seriously arguing that Trump has been anointed by God to lead this nation. He's God's chosen figure. He's risen up, blessed by God. Just things that really ought to be considered blasphemous by a lot of Christians, I would imagine. You know, this is a man, I try not to make judgments about the depth of anybody else's religious sincerity, because you don't really oftentimes know what's in someone's heart, but sometimes you do because of their behavior. And certainly in the case of Trump, the morality is just not anywhere near the level that you would think that the religious right would celebrate. Yet there they are. It's a strictly political arrangement. They're the one faction that has been sticking with him through all these troubles. 81% voted for him in the election, conservative white evangelicals, and that hasn't really wavered or dropped despite all we've been through as a nation since then. And he's paying them back. It's just political tit for tat.
And it's amazing that that calculation is so out there and so in the open, you know, by a group that is claiming they have the moral high ground, resorting to essentially something that is so much in violation of ethical standards or morality. And it just shows a deep hypocrisy. And so I'm hoping that that your organization or other groups, I'm assuming that there's going to be some sort of legal response to this 440-page set of rules?
Well, as I said, our attorneys are poring over the document. It is quite lengthy. It's extremely complicated. It's extremely dense. So we'll see what happens there. But I do think that there is going to be a strong pushback to this, whether it takes place in the courts or just in the arena of public opinion or other venues, and especially when these stories start to come in. And we're hearing some already. I mean, during the pharmacist business we talked about earlier, there were very compelling stories that came forth of people being denied medication that they needed, and as people were denied medical service that they're needed. I think that that's going to make a difference. And that the tide of public opinion, which I think is already on our side, will continue to strongly crest. And I'm hoping that will help us just get us back to some semblance of sanity, because we have really, in many ways, taken religious freedom, which is an extremely important concept in this country. Don't get me wrong. But we've turned it on its head, and that has to stop.
So it's one thing for an individual pharmacist to say, well, I'm not going to fill your birth control prescription, because one could conceivably go to the next pharmacist and get it done if one needed, even though that shouldn't be the case. But it's another thing for, say, a health insurance company to make a denial, or an entire, you know, clinic or hospital or institution. Does this document give cover to, you know, beyond individuals?
Well, I haven't been reading it. Our attorneys have been reading it. But I think certainly an argument can be made like that, because if you can extrapolate what some of the business owners have done in the healthcare arena. Remember, there were firms like Hobby Lobby and some of these other firms that said, we're not going to cover contraceptives for anybody. And that was it. It's done. And that was because of the religious beliefs of the owner of the company. So if you extrapolate from there, yeah, we've definitely got a problem on our hands with one individual basically making a decision that affects potentially thousands of people, if not more.
And so finally, do you hope that there is enough sentiment among Americans to counter this? I mean, we, like it or not, are a very religious nation. Most Americans don't question the interweaving of, you know, the words God in, you know, things like the Pledge of Allegiance and other things. And we sort of take it for granted. Is there an appetite to push back? There's certainly, you know, we certainly know that abortion rights are popular. A majority of Americans support women's right to choose whether or not they want to have an abortion. But on these sorts of rules, especially given how obscure and technical they are and this lengthy set of documents, I'm wondering if there is a public appetite to fight it.
I hope so. I mean, I do think that one thing Americans have said loud and clear is that they're concerned about their health care. And they find the system to be, you know, not very responsive as it is. So to be putting additional roadblocks or barriers in the way of people's ability to access care, that is a very serious thing. We already have enough of those. I mean, if you think about the gatekeepers we have right now before you can get your health care, there's enough of them out there. Allowing somebody to come in and add more on about grounds of religion, I hope that that's going to wake people up. But sometimes, I mean, it pains me to say this, sometimes things have to really get bad before people realize this is serious and start to fight back. And some rights have to be lost or put in jeopardy to get folks to realize the seriousness of the issue. I take no pleasure in saying that, but that may be where we are.
Rob, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Give out a website where people can find out more about the work you do.
Absolutely. Just reach us at au.org. Very simple, au.org. And you can find out all about what we're doing there and how to interact with us on social media as well.
We'll post a link to that from our website. Thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
My guest has been Rob Boston, Director of Communications at Americans United for Separation of Church and State. We've been discussing Trump's announced rules enabling discrimination. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A panel discussion about free speech and Palestinian rights at the University of Massachusetts, taking place May 4th, has become yet another flashpoint in the fight to speak out freely on a contentious topic. Well-known commentators like Linda Sarsour, Mark Lamont Hill, and Vijay Prashad were being advertised as speakers for the event, which is called Not Backing Down, Israel, Free Speech, and the Battle for Palestinian Rights. Well, a panel on the backlash against pro-Palestinian voices itself ironically faced a backlash with a legal request to stop the panel from taking place. But a judge has just ruled that the First Amendment does not have an exception when it comes to discussing Palestinian rights. The lawsuit attempting to stop the panel is one of many such attempts to squash any and all discussion of Palestinian rights around the U.S. We go now to Massachusetts to speak with Rachel Weber, who is an attorney based there, and Joseph Levine, a professor and chair of philosophy at UMass Amherst. Both of them are also members of Western Mass Jewish Voice for Peace. Welcome to the program, Rachel and Joseph.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
So first, tell us a little bit about who launched the lawsuit and what their basis for this is.
Sure. The lawsuit was launched on behalf of three unnamed anonymous UMass students. The filings indicated that they were Jewish students who were concerned that if the event went forward on UMass's campus, that it would amount to a violation of UMass's discrimination policy, because in discussing Palestinian human rights, that would amount to anti-Semitism. So those are the group launching the lawsuit.
So you didn't even know who was launching it. And so in defending yourself against this suit, tell us what happened and what the judge's decision was.
Certainly. So initially, the only defendants that were named in the suit was a number of people on the Board of Trustees and in the administration of UMass. JVP is one of the co-sponsors of the event, and we really wanted to intervene in the lawsuit to make sure that our concerns were made known to the judge. And so we filed a motion to intervene and ended up in communication with the panelists and the event organizers, ended up filing a motion to intervene on behalf of Jewish Voice for Peace, Students for Justice in Palestine, Sut Jali, who is the organizer of the event, and his organization, the Media Education Foundation, as well as Linda Sarsour, Roger Waters, Mark Lamont Hill, and Dave Zirin, who are the panelists, as well as the moderator, Vijay Prashad. So we filed a motion to intervene to address our concerns with the filings, which really amounted to a smear campaign against the panelists, as well as a deep mischaracterization of what the event was all about and what its impact would be on campus.
Speaking of a smearing of the panelists, Vijay Prashad on his Facebook page posted a poster that had been making the rounds of social media directly targeting the event and the panelists, filled with lies. The poster is entitled Meet the Anti-Semites, speaking at UMass on May 4th, and it has all of the panelists and the moderator listed. For example, Vijay Prashad is being accused of conspiracizing that Hitler and Zionists planned the Holocaust together, and other such, pretty false smears, especially for anybody who's followed the work of people like Vijay Prashad, Linda Sarsour, and others. Joseph Levine, what do you make of this really strong propaganda campaign?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not surprised. I mean, this kind of rhetoric, I have been working on behalf of Palestinian rights off and on in various groups since the early 1980s. And this kind of vilification of Palestinian solidarity activists as being terrorists, as supporting, blowing up women and children, being neo-Nazis, this is just the rhetoric that has been going on for decades. What's significant now is that finally people are pushing back and they're saying, you know what, we're not going to put up with this kind of nonsense. You either argue with us with respect and civility and actually respond to what we're saying and not to some fantasy you have about who we are, or we're going to ignore you because we're not going to respond to these kinds of things. They're as nonsensical as anything you could imagine on the alt-right or in the minds of any of the extreme white supremacist groups.
Now, you bring up the alt-right, and in fact, of course, the figures among the alt-right, such as white supremacists like Richard Spencer or the provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos, have claimed some of the same things that pro-Palestinian groups have been claiming, which is they have the First Amendment right to speak out on campuses. And unfortunately, pro-Palestinian voices have been equated with some of these dangerous white supremacist groups. What do you make of that?
Well, that's the tactic. The idea, in fact, it's not, they would have loved to have stopped this. Of course, they would have loved to have won the injunction, but they probably didn't expect to. what they want to do, and this is why we intervened, is they want to put us in the same box as these other hate groups. Now, hate groups have First Amendment rights too. And there are, of course, issues that cover Mahlo Yiannopoulos and Richard Spencer because they have free speech rights, and we have to respect those. But if you can characterize the Palestine Solidarity activists as being in that group and then only defend them on this narrow First Amendment grounds, you've won the battle, because then you have framed us as being part of the margins and filled with hate. Of course, that's nonsense. If anything, many of the right-wing Zionists are much closer to those groups and for those and those sentiments. When you see some of the right-wing Zionist rhetoric about Palestinians and Arabs and Muslims, you realize, oh, yes, yeah, they do have a home, and that home is on the far right. And it's not a coincidence that today some of Israel's best friends in the world are far-right governments, like the sort of fascist governments in Hungary and in Austria and in the Gulf states, because there is a certain sense of racial ethnic supremacy and authoritarianism that they all share. And the thing is that we in this movement, the Linda Sarsours and Roger Waters and all those people, we're on the side of human rights, humanism, the idea that everybody is equal, and we oppose Zionism because we oppose the idea of an ethnically established state. We want a state for all its citizens. How could that possibly be counted as anti-Semitic?
And Rachel, as an attorney, isn't there a difference between speaking about a certain issue and inciting violence? Some of the white supremacist speakers, you know, for example, Mahlo Yiannopoulos had threatened to out undocumented students at campuses he was to speak at. And so there is a very clear difference, right? You don't have a First Amendment protection for speech that could literally jeopardize the safety of individuals, which I don't think pro-Palestinian groups have ever done that.
Right. And so that's actually what the judge's ruling was based on. The judge said that the plaintiffs in this case had not shown a shred of evidence that there was any kind of risk of actual harm that would be coming to any of these students on campus. And the issue is all about how you define things. If you define violence as criticizing Israel, you know, if you define anti-Semitism as standing up for Palestinian human rights, then you can make all of the arguments you want, but they're based on faulty premises. And this was part of our argument to the judge, that aside from the First Amendment analysis, which might say, look, even despicable viewpoints, you know, deserve to be heard, that was not our stance in court. Our stance was, these viewpoints are not despicable. They are not anti-Semitic. These are human rights advocates who deserve to be heard on a university campus. A university is supposed to be a place of learning, a vibrant intellectual community. And this, in particular, was a panel about the censorship and repression that is faced by people who are outspoken about advocating for Palestinian rights. Just like the lawsuit is exactly an example of why this panel needs to take place. And so, you know, it really ended up being, you know, the parties arguing about definitions. Because, you know, if you say, well, you know, anything critical of Israel is violence against Israel and therefore violence against Jews, and those are huge jumps in logic you have to make that many, many Jews in this country and across the world would disagree with, then, you know, then you can say whatever you want to say about the panelists who may advocate for Palestinian human rights.
And now, unfortunately, it's not just those on the right who conflate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. For example, just about less than a week ago, the New York Times published a cartoon which many denounced as anti-Semitic. It basically showed Benjamin Netanyahu on a leash being pulled by Donald Trump as a blind man. And in his criticism of the cartoon in the New York Times, opinion columnist Brett Stevens, the op-ed was entitled A Despicable Cartoon in the Times. And what he wrote was that Anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism is all but indistinguishable from anti-Semitism in practice and often in intent, however much progressives try to deny this. Joseph, what do you make of this, equivalence between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism in the New York Times?
Well, that Bret Stephens does, he does it often, by the way. I've read many of his columns with that. Look, it's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. But it's based on the following idea, which I think often is not actually articulated. So what the other side will tell you in trying to equate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism is they'll say, you see, Zionism is the movement for the national self-determination of the Jewish people. So if you oppose Zionism, you are opposing the right for Jews to have self-determination. And therefore, that's a kind of anti-Semitism. That is their basic argument. If you go back to all the definitions of anti-Semitism that they look at, coming from the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, taken up by the State Department, taken up, you know, by the UC Regents recently, I think. I mean, this is all what it's based on. And the problem is, it's a fallacy. It's a complete and utter fallacy. Jews have a right of self-determination in the sense that we have the right to be full citizens in any nation that we live in. Yes, that we have. But no people, it's not just Jews, no people ethnically defined have the right to set up a state in sovereignty in an area and claim this state belongs to us and minorities can just be tolerated. That is not a democratic idea. So Zionism is opposed to some of the most fundamental principles of democracy. And it's interestingly, and if you go back to the early movement of Zionism, the late 19th, early 20th century, many, many Jewish leaders, I mean, really well-respected leaders, the heads of the Jewish community in Great Britain and others, objected to political Zionism. This is the Zionism we're talking about, the idea that there can be a Jewish state that is for the Jews. They objected largely on the grounds, interestingly, that this was a dangerous doctrine because it kind of racializes Jews. It makes them into a people apart from other people. And people had been working since the beginning of the Enlightenment in the movement to emancipate Jews from the ghettos to say, no, we're not a separate race. It's a religion. It's a community, but we can be just as good English citizens and French citizens and German citizens as anybody else. So in opposition to what was then thought of as the progressive way of emancipating Jews from all the restrictions they had had in medieval and Renaissance Europe, these people are coming along and saying, no, we are a nation apart and we don't belong in your countries and we have to go and take over this other one. Well, many Jews found that extremely dangerous and anti-democratic, and they were opposed.
And it's exactly this kind of discussion that you have laid out and these ideas that you have laid out that, of course, it seems as though the pro-Israel, the pro-right-wing Israel forces want to prevent from taking place. What about the victories that some are now enjoying to preserve the right to have such discussions? In Texas, there was a judge that ruled recently that a woman who was fired because she refused to sign essentially a loyalty oath on Israel had her First Amendment rights violated. It was basically part of Texas's law to try to stop the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement. Do you see that as a victory, Rachel?
We're seeing a lot of new tactics that are being used by people who want to criminalize and delegitimize the BDS movement, and in doing so, the call for Palestinian civil society for international help to their predicament. And in response to those new tactics, there's always new resistance. And so, for every legal attack that we're seeing crop up, there is there's an organized, powerful, intersectional resistance to those efforts because people can see a number of different connections here, where it's a slippery slope. Once you start saying that particular speech is not okay because of the differences of certain opinions about definitions, well, what's next? And then also a recognition that the struggle for Palestinian human rights isn't occurring in isolation. It's connected to struggles for self-determination and dignity and peace that are shared by communities around the world, including in this country. There's been an amazing confluence between the Black Lives Matter movement and the movements for Palestinian human rights. And so people see these efforts for what they are and continue to be creative and resilient and determined in resisting them.
And of course, there is a real reason to fear a return of anti-Semitism today in the United States, right? We had 6 months ago the synagogue massacre in Pittsburgh, and an attempted massacre that resulted in one death in Southern California here near San Diego, where we're based in Southern California, the Poway Synagogue. And those sorts of attacks, some on the right, such as Senator Ted Cruz and Meghan McCain, were attempting to connect to Congresswoman Ilhan Omar's criticism of the state of Israel and saying that it's people like her who have been encouraging anti-Semitism. What do you make of that, Joseph?
Well, first of all, the people that are carrying out those attacks, they hate Ilhan Omar just as much as they hate us.
I mean, right. The guy was the suspect in the synagogue shooting has been charged with setting fire to a mosque in Escondido, right?
And I think he said he was inspired by the New Zealand massacre. Mm-hmm. This is what we were talking about earlier. There is this constant attempt to put us in a box. It's really interesting. I mean, you know, there are real issues about the rhetoric that's coming out of the Trump administration, you know, the fine people on both sides of Charlottesville and all that, where I think it's legitimate to say that he is opening up space for people to take it to the next level and actually incite attacks on Muslims, immigrants, and Jews. But the political establishment, especially the Republican Party, and I have to say some members of the Democratic Party, are refusing to draw those connections and instead are drawing the connection between the movement for Palestinian human rights and these anti-Semitic attacks. But there's no actual history of any kind of interaction between these sorts of groups. They are really, in fact, antithetically opposed to each other. The Palestinian rights activists are human rights activists. They care about the fact that, I mean, look, in 2014, Israel went into Gaza and massacred 2,500 people, 500 children. That's what is moving us, right? And all of this other stuff is nonsense, and they're just trying to hide because they don't actually have any arguments. Mm-hmm. All they have is smearing.
So then, do you feel that any of these attempts have had a chilling effect on speech? I mean, especially on campuses where there has been a flowering of groups, you know, emboldened to speak out about Palestinian rights, including many young American Jews. Have these recent efforts to criminalize speech about Palestinian rights had any kind of a chilling effect, as far as you can tell, on the work that groups like Students for Justice in Palestine do?
Well, I think that, you know, I certainly think that it's true that they are, the intimidation that groups like Students for Justice in Palestine is receiving is real. And the various attacks on other supporters of Palestine on campuses and elsewhere is very real.
And we have the example of Mark Lamont Hill, right? One of the panelists at the May 4th event, who lost his position at CNN because of his criticism of the state of Israel.
Exactly. So there are real consequences that people are facing, and yet they still speak because they're moved. And the Students for Justice in Palestine still organize because they're moved to. And Mark Lamont Hill is coming to this panel to speak because he's moved to. So while the efforts at repression are incredibly dangerous and incredibly real. People are resisting against it and still being guided by their conscience and doing what they can to advocate for Palestinian human rights.
Well, you know, they are having a backlash because they're pissing people off. It's getting to the point where people are saying, "Oh, come on, we're just not going to stand for this anymore." So in that sense, I think we've seen a sea change, maybe in the last 5-6 years.
And so finally, do you hope that the panel that is actually trying to discuss this very issue of how these voices are being, you know, attempted to be silenced, is that panel discussion going to be made available for the general public? Because, of course, we do need such discussions. I understand that the Media Education Foundation is hopefully going to be taping it.
That's my understanding, is that it won't be live streamed, but that it will be taped and available for public consumption.
And so, of course, getting that out to a wider audience will exactly, serve the purpose, I hope, that the panelists have been trying to serve.
Yes, definitely.
Exactly.
Where can people find out more about the work that Jewish Voice for Peace does?
Well, Jewish Voice for Peace National has a website, jewishvoiceforpeace.org. And from that website, you can click on a map and find out the chapter that's closest to you if you're interested in engaging in that work. There's also many different chapters have Facebook pages, including Jewish Voice for Peace Western Mass. And it's just JVPWMASS. If you search that on Facebook, you'll find us.
And we'll link to that from our website later today. I want to thank the two of you so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Take care. My guests have been Rachel Weber. She's an attorney based in Massachusetts, and Joseph Levine, professor and chair of philosophy at UMass Amherst. Both of them also members of Western Mass Jewish Voice for Peace. We've been discussing ongoing efforts to stop discussions of Palestinian rights. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Kitsap. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.